two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, welcome back to KSL Outdoors Radio, and thanks again for the news update there on the half hour. Any breaking news, of course, you can always count on getting it from Utah's news station here. Tim, Russ, and Navi, I want to jump in immediately to this conversation with Bob Grove, who we love to call our Southern Utah correspondent, because there's a story right in his neck of the woods this week that's gotten a lot of attention. ATVs will be allowed on certain roads in the five national parks in Utah under a new rule that the National Park Service itself pass through without public comment, which is sort of an interesting move to me. The rule, taking effect November 1st, only applies to the parks in Utah, and they say it's to conform with a state law that was passed in 2008 that allows any street-legal vehicle on state or county roads. Bob, I'm curious about the timing of this. The state law passed 11 years ago. So why all of a sudden, and why without public comment?
Well, I think there was a big push from the OHV community on the side that got to our legislators that helped push it through. But, you know, the parks, this is what I've found strange over the years of working so much with the parks as I do, is that there's no uniform policy, it seems, that every park is independently managed by the superintendent. So they're, you know, going to Grand Canyon, to Yellowstone, Zion, and so forth. They all kind of govern their parks separately and not in a uniform manner. There are some things that are uniform in terms of commercial operators, et cetera, but generally speaking, I think it's at the discretion of the local, the park superintendent.
Well, I can tell you, we found that on our motorcycles because some national parks, when we were doing our border-to-border thing, some national parks you can get two motorcycles in with one pass, and others laugh at you because that's never been the rule.
And I've asked at the gates at
Glacier.
Yosemite with my brother, so how many bikes do you allow in the park with one pass? They said, all you want.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I found, is that it's left up to the discretion of the superintendent. So we're not going to find a one-size-fits-all with the National Park Service.
Do you think they just felt that this was enough of a supercharged issue that opening it up for public comment would not solve a thing?
Well, yeah, you know, it would go into a big debate, as they always do, these issues. There's always two sides that seem to be butting heads over this issue, and you know, they made a pretty legitimate case about allowing this, because it's just on the same roads that all other vehicles are on. I mean, it's the same roads that your Jeeps go on, your trucks go on, your automobiles go on. It's not going off road. Even, you know, these vehicles, these machines, have a reputation of going off road, but those that have been are street legal. They've gone through the modifications to become street legal, and they're licensed, and they pay taxes on the roads. Mm-hmm. And everything that you and I pay with our automobiles, they said, you know, why can't we go in when everybody else can?
So the the expectation is that those that have gone the extra mile to do that, to make them street legal, may be the more responsible of the group. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of stating it. You know, I've worked a lot. I don't own an off-road machine. I don't have an ATV or UTV, but I work a lot with clubs. And what I found is that these clubs are really well organized. They're very good about policing themselves. They are good stewards of the land. I see them all the time out picking up trash in the parks and doing things like that. There's always that rogue off-roader. You know, it's going to go off-road, and but there's bad apples in every group, right?
Yeah.
You know, one of the, generally speaking, these are great guys that really are concerned about making sure that everybody plays by the rules.
Well, and let me give you my positive side of this. The positive side is I can't think of a better way to see, and it's the reason we ride motorcycles, Russ. When you go into a national park, you can see everything.
True.
You don't have a roof over your head, and the view is so much better on the motorcycle, at least we feel that way, than it is in a car. And the same could be true on an ATV. Now, if you're on a UHV, you're still going to have a little roof over your head, but you've got more freedom to look out the window. That's the positive side. The negative side is, and we've had conversations, Bob, about this on the show recently, is the overcrowding. And if you've got people coming in on ATVs only one body at a time, not many people, I guess, would go through the park with only one person in the car. But one ATV might cause more of a congestion problem than we already have.
Well, and that has the potential of doing that, but I don't think it's any different than those who are going in on motorcycles. You know, it's usually only one or two people on a motorcycle that's going in. So, yeah, I can see that because we already have several layers of visitors going mm-hmm. into the parks, and how many sardines can you cram into a can? You know, I'm finding that in many of these parks that now the parks are coming up with shuttle systems to try to prevent that congestion from happening. You know, as an example, Zion, the only way you can get into Zion Canyon is by shuttle during the busy season. Bryce recently, you can still go into the park in your own vehicles, but they're allowing only 1 hour of parking in each of the parking areas, especially on busy days, and I just find it so much easier just to take the shuttle in. To be honest with you, I don't know that all of a sudden everybody who owns an ATV or UTV is going to quickly be heading to the parks, jumping in and going in that way. I think that it's just something for those who take their vehicle, you know, their machines with them to areas where there is off-roading that's near a national park. Would like to have that as an option of being able to just drive their OHV into the park while they're already there.
Yeah, and your argument about, you know, motorcycles causing the same congestion problems is fair. And the noise issue is another one that's come up. And I guess motorcycles would also be noisier than the average car.
Real noisy. Real noisy, Tim.
Yeah. Not you BMW drivers, these Honda guys. So the noise thing may also be cancelable, I guess, if that's a word, because motorcycles are already allowed in there to do it.
Here's another point, Tim. You know, people are saying, well, I don't want to deal with the noise and the congestion. That they're going to deal with that regardless of whether these vehicles are going to be coming in. There are so many other places. If they want a nature experience, and I'm just saying this from personal experience because I know where those places are where you can get away from it, and it's more there's far more of that available in the parks than where the visitors go. I have a saying that tourists follow pavement. You know, so if you want to go where the tourists are, just follow the pavement. So if you want to get away from the crowds and the noise, just go on some of the primitive trails. Go back into the wilderness area. Get into the backcountry. You'll find that you're going to get all that you can eat at back there in terms of solitude and serenity.
Yeah. I also, one of the stories, and I've been bouncing around to different ones, but one of the stories was making the point that the policy change will allow the off-road vehicles to drive on well-known roads, and they listed among them Canyonlands National Park's White Rim. Weren't they already allowed on White Rim Trail?
Yeah. I mean, if you're up at Dead Horse Point or at Grand View or any of these places looking down at the White Rim Trail, what are you seeing down there? You're seeing Jeeps and other off-road, you know, they're already there.
That's why I wondered why this was even part of the story.
Well, the superintendent in Canyonlands has been fighting this issue for some time. I mean, the superintendent there has been very much opposed to off-road vehicles in any regard. So this has been a fight that they've been waging for some time. So, this is going to allow more of that type of traffic going into areas where really the best type of vehicle to get there is in an off-road vehicle.
Yeah.
You know, you can take mountain bikes there, too, but you're not going to take your sedan down there and drive around. So,
unless it's a Subaru.
You know, this makes sense.
I remember, some real show of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not resistance, but it was Representative Phil Lyman, I think, who led an ATV protest out through Southern Utah Canyon that was off limits to vehicles several years ago.
Yeah, recap. Yeah, Recapture Canyon.
Right. Yeah, and he was a county commissioner. My guess is he's happy about this ruling, and I saw one quote from an ATV rider who said, look, you want to talk about offended? I was offended that off-highway vehicles weren't allowed in the park since most of them are accessed by state and county roads.
Exactly. You know, and this is, you know, they've been allowing off-road vehicles in, if correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that they've been allowing off-road vehicles on the roads in Yellowstone for a number of years now.
Yeah, I don't know.
And
that.
Haven't seen any real issues with that. I haven't, you know, I get alerts on everything that's happening in the parks, and I haven't come across anything saying that it's become an issue there.
Huh. They do warn everyone, of course, that if you're caught going off on some of the side trails or something where you're not supposed to be, you're certainly going to get cited. But enforcement of breaking those rules, I guess, is of a concern because in many of these national parks, budgets are small and the number of actual rangers that are there to write those citations, they just can't be everywhere at the same time.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, as a professional guide, the parks expect me to be another set of eyes and ears for them. They see, they've asked me, and they often shadowed me to make sure that I am saying and doing the right things, that when I see rules being broken, it's my job to go and educate people and let them know what's going on. I think the OHV community will police themselves. I can guarantee you that. I know some of these guys that are in these clubs that are officers, and that if they see someone going off the trail, they're going to immediately talk to that person and correct it. They are very much concerned about making sure that their community stays within the rules and doesn't ruin it for the rest of them.
Yeah, I hope that's the case. So again, the rule takes effect November 1st. It only applies if you're listening outside of the state of Utah, which many do, to this program or reaching out on the amazing signal of KSL in 12 western states. Only applies to the national parks in Utah, the five that are here. So, you know, just because you heard it here doesn't mean you can do it anywhere other than Zion, Canyonlands, Arches, Bryce Canyon, or Capitol Reef. Bob, great catching up with you.
Always good to visit with you guys. Come on down sometime. Let's go visit a park.
I think you said that last week.
Well,
I'm still waiting. It's an open offer, open invitation.
It's road tripping with Bob, yeah. Right?
Roadtrippingwithbob.com.
All right, buddy. Thanks again.
You bet. Thank you, guys.
Don't go away. Fish Bites is coming up next.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
That love to fish.
One day at the tackle shop, his dream came true, and now for everyone he catches, she catches too.
Hey, Bubba, she fishes better than you.
You're probably finding this to be true at this year's fishing class.
No, every year.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah, by far.
The ladies always, 100% of the time, outfish the men. Always.
And bringing them to your class is the best thing to do.
Right.
Trying to teach them yourself is...
No, you're stupid.
If you want a divorce, go ahead and do it. You know?
Bring them to me. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
But no, I pretty much tell all my students when we start, the gentlemen... put their ego in their back pocket because they are going to get outfished. And then when it happens, they go, you were serious? I go, of course I'm serious. Everybody asks me why that's the case. And it's true. Women have this Obi-Wan Kenobi understanding of things, but mostly they just pay attention.
It's intensity.
Yeah, they
it's the same with shooting, target shooting. Women are much better than men.
Well, here's the thing. In your class specifically, when we were in the class, we noticed guys in the back that start off, and we've told this story before, standing up in the back of the room with their arms crossed, giving you a little body language like, okay, what do you got? Because I've fished for years. Let's see what you can teach
me. I love when they actually say it.
The ladies come in, and they're anxious to learn.
Right. No, absolutely. They do what you say.
I love the guys that come in and say, yeah, I was fishing down the Prover last weekend and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And you're going, yeah, okay.
Yeah. No, I know.
Hey, let's talk community ponds for a minute, because we mentioned October is among the best months of the year to fish in Utah, because the temperatures are cooler, the water temperatures are changing, and the fish are hungry because they sense that Mother Nature is telling them soon you're going to be covered with a bunch of ice and it's not going to be as easy to feed.
Right. They got
to
get on their fast stores. Yeah. There's no question.
Yeah. And you don't have to go far from home. I was just looking at the stocking report, which, by the way, if you go to wildlife.utah.gov, click on the fishing portal, you can see the exact day, the number of fish that they put in.
Give me some numbers,
what
Tim.
What species? Well, Bountiful Pond is a good example. They stocked on the 12th, the 18th, and the 23rd. All rainbow trout, 181 day, 140 the next day, and most recently, 1,375 rainbow.
There you go.
Went in there. The nice. Average size, 9.5 inches.
Yeah, that's fine. You need to understand that trout need 45 to 55 degrees. That's their temp. And you can't get that in the summers. So putting those fish into the community ponds during the summer, they're going to die. They can't cope. But now we get in those cool nights, with those long nights, we get the temperatures down. It's perfect. So here's when they put them in. So go catch them. And by the way, take them home, because they don't have the mercury levels because they were in the hatchery. So they're going to be fine. And then they'll make it, some of them will make it through the winter. They will. And then they'll put some more in the spring. But by June, they're gone, and they should be gone because they'll die anyway.
So they really want you to go catch these and take them home with you.
Absolutely.
Get them out of there.
Yeah. And it's a blast. And don't underestimate them. I got some photos. Finn has got hog photos from the Kaysville Pond. There's a little kid down there. I call him the mayor of the Kaysville Pond. I call him the house fishing. And he's like, oh, they're taking this. They're taking that. And it's fabulous. And it's close. And it's a resource that our fine state provides.
Kaysville Pond, if you're looking for stocking, it doesn't look like they've done any since June, which surprises me a little bit. But the last time they did, they put about 500 channel catfish in there.
Yeah, they'll be fine.
Sizable fish. They're almost 14 inches.
Yeah, yeah. Channel cats will work all summer long, but pretty soon they're going to put the rainbows in there, too.
Yeah, in the dark of the night.
Yeah. The other good thing about the community ponds is it's great for just a bobber and a worm.
Oh, well, every place is good with a bobber and a worm. But those cats, if you're fishing for those cats, give your little worm a little WD-40 spray and put it below the bobber, and you could take it down to the bottom because they're not very deep, or you could keep it suspended. Either way, you're going to catch plenty of fish, and the kids just love it. I mean, that's a perfect place to spend an afternoon. You can walk there. There's Kaysville Pond. There's Bountiful Ponds, there's Syracuse Pond, there's Steeds Pond. There's so many ponds in all of our communities, and people look at them and they just, snub their nose because they underestimate how good those little fisheries are.
As I look through this stocking report, it's not just community fisheries, by the way. It's all of the fishing waters in Utah. A lot of them are regular reservoirs that have been stocked in the last month or so. Is there a method to the madness of stocking this time of year?
Yeah, it has more to do with what the truck can reach. So they back that truck up, and wherever they can get to the waters where they go in.
Rockport just received a whole bunch of fish. Rainbows on the, they've had several on the 23rd, the 24th. But they did a lot of stocking on the 23rd. All rainbows, by the way, in as large amounts as 1,800 that were 11.5 inches long. So, yeah. And the fish come out of the fishing, what's the word? I can't
believe hatchery.
The hatchery. Hungry, too, don't they?
Well, they feed them plenty of liver pellets because they have a transitional moment before they really acclimate. But then they're hungry, yeah. They got to eat like we got to eat. I'm hungry right now.
Yeah. Well, that's our suggestion, is to get out there and enjoy some of the community ponds.
Go fishing. This is the time of year. Like when I wake up in the morning now and I walk to work, I want, dang it, I want to go fishing because this is when you fish.
Yeah. All right, Nobby. Right after the top of the hour, we got an ABC News update coming. And on the other side, Randy Oplinger will join us. And we'll talk about some other places outside of the community fisheries, some of the other fisheries in Utah that you might want to go and give a try here in the next couple of weeks. So stay right there.